Coming up, should theological seminaries teach science to their students? Lucky Severson reports on the debate over whether that will help future ministers or threaten their faith. Also, Fred DeSam Lazaro on a movement to help slum dwellers in India and other countries. What do the very poor say will give them the most dignity? And Judy Valente remembers the late Thomas Merton, who would have been 100 years old this week.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. During a visit to India this week, President Obama issued a strong plea for religious freedom and human dignity. Religious minorities, poor people, and women in many areas of India have faced persistent harassment and violence. The president urged that nation to uphold its constitutional guarantees of equality. Obama also paid tribute to Mahatma Gandhi's teachings about nonviolence and tolerance, and repeated Gandhi's statement that different religions are branches of the same majestic tree. As violence escalated again between Ukraine and Russian-backed separatists, religious groups around the world renewed calls for peace. At the Vatican, Pope Francis offered prayers about the situation and urged that dialogue be resumed. Also this week, the Vatican held a special service to celebrate the conversion of St. Paul to what later became Christianity. Orthodox and Anglican leaders were among the participants. Francis urged Christians of all denominations to focus on what unites them rather than their differences. In Utah, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, announced their support for statewide laws that protect gay rights, including equal access to housing and employment. However, Mormon officials said such laws must respect the religious rights of those who disagree, and they stopped short of supporting same-sex marriage. A study made public this week confirms that most Americans don't know much about Sikhs, even though they make up the fifth largest organized religion in the world. The National Sikh Campaign and Heart Research Associates said more than 60% of non-Asian Americans said they know little to nothing about Sikhs, and only 11% of respondents correctly identified a photo of a Sikh man wearing a turban. The vast majority confused him with a Muslim, Hindu, or someone from the Middle East. The Church of England this week consecrated the first female bishop in its 500-year history. Libby Lane became the eighth bishop of Stockport in a service at York Minster. After years of debate, last November, the Church of England voted to adopt legislation approving female bishops. Now, a Lucky Severson report. The American Association for the Advancement of Science has begun a program to make it possible for seminaries to offer science courses to future ministers. That has set off a debate. Some say it helps create better informed ministers. Others fear it might weaken their faith.
The friction between religion and science began long ago. Galileo, one of the fathers of modern science and a Catholic, was condemned by the church and put under lifetime house arrest, in part because he championed the controversial theory that the solar system revolves around the sun and not the earth.
I think what his real problem was is that he came across as though he was challenging church authority, and they didn't like that.
Jennifer Wiseman is the director of Dialogue on Science, Ethics, and Religion at the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the world's largest scientific society. She oversees a new program called Science for Seminaries.
And it turns out that many people actually look to their religious leaders for guidance on all kinds of things, but things including issues related to science and technology. And a lot of those religious leaders have had very little exposure to science in their training.
The Society asked seminaries to apply for grants that would enable them to incorporate more science into their religious studies. They were surprised when 28 applied. 10 were accepted, including Multnomah University in Portland, Oregon, a private non-denominational Christian school. This is Professor Paul Lewis Metzger, director of the seminary's Institute for the Theology of Culture.
So many young Christians are concerned that they don't feel that their churches are really engaging them in terms of their passions, their vocational passions. And so if they're training for the sciences and the churches themselves are not helping to equip them, there's a sense in which they're going to be lost.
Over 250 seminaries were invited to apply. Only about 10% did. Some schools felt their students had already been exposed to science, and some thought the AAAS had a materialistic scientific worldview, something they were opposed to.
There'll be pushback from a variety of domains, from a variety of individuals, communities. We might not always agree, but how can we at least seek to move forward toward a civil dialogue? And that's something I'm hoping that we'll be able to promote through this grant at the seminary.
Science for seminaries is just getting underway. Some schools don't start the program till next semester. But at this class at Multnomah, they are already asking the big questions. This is Katrina Johnson.
Well, it's interesting that some neuroscientists say that there's a center of the brain they've located, and it becomes activated when people engage in these, and they call it the God Center.
This is Derek Peterson, a Divinity Master's student.
I think there's a lot of mythology that gets traded around on all sides about what we believe, about what scientists believe. There's a lot of parsing that needs to go on, a lot of education just to kind of say, look, there's not all these monsters hiding in the shadows of things that we don't know.
A survey by the American Association for the Advancement of Science found that almost a third of evangelicals see a conflict between religion and science and side with religion. Another poll by the Associated Press suggested that half of Americans, including 77% of evangelicals, are skeptical that the universe began with the Big Bang or that the Earth is 4.5 billion years old. At the Creation Museum in Northern Kentucky, visitors can witness the Bible story of how the Earth was created in just 6 days, literally 6 days.
The Bible's the Bible, you know. God created the Earth and all of it in 6 days. Can't argue with God.
Creationism is a huge stumbling block for a lot of Christians in this country, and as a Christian myself, I really find that regrettable because it needn't be.
Daryl Domning is a vertebrate paleontologist in the College of Medicine at Howard University. He's a devout Catholic and one of the scientists who will be helping seminary professors under the grant program. He has no problem with evolution.
I have found personally in my own faith life that a lot of Christianity in general, makes more sense in the light of evolution than otherwise.
Donche Watkins is a second-year Master's of Divinity student at the Howard Divinity School. She believes the Earth was created in 6 days.
I'm not worried that I will learn anything to shake my faith, but I am excited about the possibility on expanding on it.
Sometimes faith has to be challenged in order for faith to really be genuine faith.
Professor Frederick Ware is head of the Science for Seminaries program at the Howard Divinity School.
If it's not a conversation that unsettles them, it's very unlikely that they're going to have an opportunity to grow, to broaden their horizons, to think differently.
I would hope that I'm challenged at every turn, and that shows I'm alive.
The Scopes trial, also known as the Scopes monkey trial in 1925, had a huge impact on Christian fundamentalists. A high school teacher was vilified and found guilty of teaching evolution in Tennessee, which was illegal at the time.
You believe in evolution?
I wouldn't quite say I believe in evolution.
Matthew Riley III is a second-year divinity student at Howard and the son of a pastor.
We have just started our studies and our systematic theology course in evolution and looking at how, as ministers, we can begin to incorporate some scientific theory in our ministry. But to say I believe in it is not something that I'm quite ready to say.
The type of cultural warfare that's taking place and people are already settled into certain camps, I think that for us to talk about religion and science, we have to deal with topics that have a broad base of appeal to people beyond just the battle between creationism and evolution.
There is a universe of questions about science that the seminaries will be looking into.
If our Earth is not the only inhabitable world, what does that imply?
How does human life develop? How did the world develop? That's certainly a key question that we hear about.
We want pastors to understand how what we know now in neuroscience and cognitive science can help them understand how people respond in situations of distress.
Matters of the soul. Are we just material entities? What's the difference between animals and humans?
There's another side of the equation. What can science learn from religion?
Science is good at coming up with the facts of the matter, but then where do we get our values, our means of making judgments about should we do this or not? And I think that's the most obvious thing that the religious perspective can bring, is a sense of values, a compass, if you will.
Any other thoughts?
Science for Seminaries is funded as a two-year project, but the hope, at least at the Association for the Advancement of Science, is that it will expand to other seminaries and to more people of faith. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Washington.
We have a Fred DeSam Lazaro report today from Mumbai in India, where there's a movement to help confer dignity on the 10 million or more people who live there in slums. One dedicated man has spent many years of his life organizing slum dwellers, especially women, to demand respectful and generous help from their government. And his approach is now in use around the world.
Few cities display a wider gap between haves and have-nots than Mumbai or Bombay. Real estate is costlier here than in Manhattan, yet two-thirds of this city of 16 million people live in slums, crammed spaces that are technically illegal and by most measures unfit or unsafe for human habitation.
I translate that into...
It's here that Jokin Arputham is a towering figure, even though he's barely 5 feet tall. His efforts have helped nearly 40,000 families get out of dangerous and unsanitary improvised shelters to complexes like this one, which is now providing new homes for squatters who were living under electric towers. Those are due to be rebuilt and expanded.
So you have 600 families here?
Yes.
600. And how much of a dent does that make? Are there many more families who still need to be rehabilitated?
There are about 3,000 families to be rehabilitated in this kind of scheme.
And this is just people who are squatting in electric towers?
Yes.
The apartments may not look like much, one 225-square-foot room, but of brick and mortar instead of plywood or tarp. They have running water and something the majority of Bombay's residents don't, a private toilet. Of all the indignities suffered by slum dwellers, Arputham says, none is more humiliating than not having a toilet, private or public.
It is a dignity. If you don't have a toilet, what does that mean?
You don't have dignity.
Exactly.
Arputham has spent much of his adult life trying to gain recognition for slum dwellers as citizens in legitimate communities. He says they've long been unfairly stereotyped as lazy and criminal.
Everybody, every house has one person meaningfully earning.
Meaningfully employed.
Meaningfully employed.
Right. And they come from all over the country
All over the country.
Arputham came to this city 50 years ago from South India. He had almost no formal education, but a facility for languages, picking up Hindi dominant in North India, the local Marathi, and functional English. He used these talents to organize neighbors into a group that's now global, called Slum Dwellers International, taking advantage of their numbers, he says, to get the attention of an often indifferent government bureaucracy.
I create a critical mass. This is my critical mass.
They've used guerrilla tactics, nonviolent, he insists, to push for their rights or basic amenities like water hookups. If the city ignores or takes too long to respond to their request, Arpatham takes the task on himself.
I'm going to break open a water tap, giving the connection to them.
You're going to tap into the pipes?
I've done it 1,000 times. When the police come, I put children in the first, then women.
Today, he says there's no trouble getting the electric utility to fund relocation for squatters who've lived under their towers, or getting campaigning politicians to support the group's push for upgraded housing and especially public toilets.
This is for little more than around 600 families.
600
families.
Who don't have a toilet now.
Who don't have a toilet.
When he began building community-run public toilets like this one 25 years ago, the funds mostly came from foreign aid agencies, he says.
Now, slowly, it has become a city's responsibility. The city government, municipal corporation, totally pays for the capital investment of this construction.
So far, they've completed or have contracts to build toilets serving some 600,000 people. Once built, they are run by the community, supported by user fees, about 2 U.S. cents per day for a family. A family, in this case Mamta and Dalcher Bidlan, is hired to maintain the facility in exchange for a small apartment above the structure. Mamta Bidlan says having a toilet nearby means a lot to women, for whom this has long been a safety issue.
The women had to go a long distance before, and there were bad men hovering from outside that would create problems. Now it's very easy for women to come here.
Arpatham credits much of the organization's success to its mostly female volunteers. Women have the right priorities for their families, he says, and they are keenly tuned in to goings-on in the community.
If you want a qualitative change in life, you have to take it from women. If you don't recognize that, you're gone. You're lost.
What kinds of things specifically?
Everything, starting from how to manage your money, how to earn your money, how to live. Women have all this quality which men doesn't have.
For their part, the women volunteers, most of them stay-at-home spouses, by tradition as much as choice, say their lives have been transformed.
Women have gotten ahead now. In years past, women used to be afraid of leaving the home. We've been able to get them out of the home by forming an organization.
I used to be afraid of leaving the house, afraid of living in the neighborhood. Now I'm ready to do much more. He's given us the courage. He's taught us how to organize ourselves, how to deal with the police.
The police, who were once indifferent or even hostile, are now much more receptive and in fact partners with the slum dwellers group, providing space to set up a new system of arbitration so disputes over property or domestic issues don't escalate to require arrests or court intervention.
Okay, we've heard your story. Now we'll invite him in and see what he has to say.
We have people from all religions in our organization, Muslims, Hindus, no problems whatsoever.
I think part of my teaching has come from the church. I think quite a lot in my work I practice.
Arpatham was raised Roman Catholic, a small minority in a land of many faiths and often religious tension. However, Slum Dwellers International, a group that now has chapters in 34 countries, says the common cause slum dwellers face easily dwarfs any division of ethnicity or faith. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred DeSamlazaro in Mumbai, India.
Noted theologian Father Richard McBrien died this week. He was 78 years old. McBrien taught for more than three decades at the University of Notre Dame. He was a popular writer, sometimes controversial, and reached a wide audience with his many columns and books that explained Catholic doctrine, especially the reforms of Vatican II. We also remember Thomas Merton. If he had lived long enough, he would have been 100 years old this week. Merton was a hard-living young writer in the 1940s who became a Trappist monk and whose 60 or more books, plus articles, essays, and poems, encouraged monastic-like meditation and prayer for a generation of his readers and admirers. Several years ago, correspondent Judy Valente went to Gethsemane Abbey, where Merton had lived. Here is part of her story.
Sunrise at the Abbey of Gethsemane in the misty hills south of Louisville, Kentucky. The 55 Trappist monks who live here awake at 3 a.m. to begin their daily regimen of prayer and work in silence. They gather for communal prayer several times a day. They will rarely venture outside the walls. For most, their lives will end here.
The essence of the Trappist life would be living in God. It's a life of continual prayer.
He said that anybody could have a deeply spiritual life if they cared to.
For Merton, the deeply spiritual life meant the experience of God's presence and love at all times. In 1948, when he was 33 years old, Merton published his autobiography, The Seven-Story Mountain. The book became an overnight bestseller. Sister Suzanne Zurcher is a Benedictine nun who has written extensively about Merton.
I knew that I needed to be in monastic life. And I knew that he was someone who spoke to me in a way that nobody else had ever spoken to me. He's funny. He's profound. He's human. He's down to earth.
Merton's fame allowed him to correspond with presidents, popes, and Nobel Prize winners. But as his public reputation grew, he retreated further into solitude and silence. He would spend a few hours a day in this small wooden shed writing and meditating. But it wasn't enough.
He wanted to have more time for writing, for meditation.
He would later get permission from his abbot to live as a hermit in this tiny cottage about a half mile from the monastery. Merton wrote this in his journal.
For myself, I have only one desire, and that is the desire for solitude, to disappear into God, to be submerged in his peace, to be lost in the secret of his face. I've gone to the hermitage not because I hate the world. I go to the hermitage to deepen my consciousness, to be more in communion with the world.
In 1966, Merton spent several weeks in a Louisville hospital recovering from back surgery. There he met and fell in love with a young student nurse. He was 51 years old at the time.
It was very brief. It was very intense. It was very passionate. He sometimes felt that he had abandoned his vows, and at other times he felt he was really living the vows of growth and fulfillment.
Within a matter of months, the relationship was over, but Merton had been changed.
From that time on, he never again thought of himself as being unloved or unlovable.
Merton rededicated himself to his monastic life. He became increasingly interested in Buddhism and Asian monasticism. In 1968, he received permission to attend a conference on monasticism in Bangkok. There is rare footage of Merton from that conference.
So that's a thing of the past now, to be suspicious of other religions and to look always at that which is weakest in other religions and always at what is highest in our own religion. Because this double standard in dealing with religions. This has to stop.
Hours after this film was made, Merton was dead, electrocuted after touching a fan with faulty wiring in his hotel room. He was 53. His reputation has only grown since his death. Working with manuscripts he left behind, scholars have published 60 more of his books, including 7 volumes of his personal journals.
With the death of Thomas Merton, we lost really one of the great Catholic voices, one of the great prophetic figures within the Catholic Church.
Toward the end of his life, Merton wrote, "Our real journey is interior. For those seeking to take that journey, he remains an essential guide." For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Judy Valente at the Abbey of Gethsemane.
On our calendar this week, the Jewish holiday of Tu B'Shvat, the festival celebrating a new year for trees. Also, memorial services were held in many places around the world in honor of the 70th anniversary of the liberation of the Auschwitz concentration camp in Poland. In a special ceremony at the former camp, world leaders gathered with 300 survivors, commemorating the event with candles and prayers. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, more scenes from ceremonies marking the 70th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics Newsweekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.